Good afternoon, Mad River Valley. Sorry for that quick cutoff. This is Jerry Procaccini with the 4-H Show. And the 4-H's are health, harmony, happiness, and humor, which we all need these days. And I have a special guest today, Jennifer Stella. Jennifer's a local scientist and homeopath. She trained in microbiology and worked in international business before focusing on her family and learning about vaccine injuries and recovery options, which we hope to talk about. This was years ago. For many years, she served as a volunteer advocating for natural children's health and parents' rights to choose which vaccines and when, if any, they should give to their children. Jennifer volunteers much of her time as a chapter leader for Children's Health Defense New England, and Children's Health Defense is the organization founded by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And she also founded Health Choice Vermont. And I want to thank you very much for coming in, Jennifer. We've been trying to line her up for quite a while, and we finally managed to squeeze it in.
Thank you for having me, Jerry.
Yeah, so why don't we start a little bit with your background, where you're from, and your education, and how you ended up in Vermont.
Okay, so, well, this was probably the most convenient interview I ever had, driving down the road, right? So
oh,
I live
right,
locally
yeah.
in Waitsfield.
That's right.
And
you're probably a stone's throw from my house.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful day, although I think the roof nearly blew off last night, right?
It
was just so windy.
It was.
So windy.
Yeah.
So I guess thank you for having me. I mean, our connection, I think, is with Children's Health Defense, New England, the New England chapter, which has just been recently formed, and I'm so excited.
Yeah.
We're
really exciting.
Able to launch this chapter. And, you know, I got involved in this issue because I was a young mother. Really, at the heart of it, my background was in microbiology. I grew up in the Braintree, Massachusetts, the town of Braintree, Massachusetts. I grew up in, you know, middle class America. I grew up in a self-employed family. I was taught how to work hard and, you know, had several jobs and was in college by the time I was 17. And I was driven by really a personal story.
You were in college by the time you were 17,
mm-hmm.
So you must have been a brain.
I think I was just
you skipped a grade.
I was a spring chicken, I guess. I was young,
oh, okay.
And they didn't cut me out of kindergarten or something, which was good. I was ready for school, apparently. And when I was a teenager, my uncle, who was very much a part of our family, we were a close, close family, died of AIDS.
Oh, my goodness.
In 1985. And I knew then that I needed to find a cure. I was really driven. I've always had a sense of justice, but also, you know, the folks in my life took care of one another. And so he literally, you know, died in the arms of his family just months after he was diagnosed. It was absolutely horrible.
How old were you at the time?
I was 15. And,
wow.
You know, it was much like COVID, where, you know, people weren't allowed to come over if you didn't know the status of somebody else, right? And people were throwing rocks at each other. It was a scary time. Nobody knew. Anyhow, I decided I was going to go become a doctor. That's what I thought I would do. And microbiology was a pathway there. And I loved the natural world. So it was a perfect fit. Biology was a perfect fit for me.
Yeah.
I loved school, and I came out with a degree in microbiology. I wanted to go to medical school, but I had also taken a year to travel and see the world, and came back
addicted?
Thinking, oh, there's so much more out there. Maybe I'll work for a little while. I also had been to Europe, where they use so much natural health, right?
More than us.
Much more than us.
Yeah.
And I realized that my track going to medical school was going to be one track, but that there were other pathways to health.
Yeah,
I had already sort of started to see
mm-hmm.
there were other ways, more natural ways that you could approach health with.
I'm just wondering, when you were considering medical school, was there a difference? That would have been mid-80s ish?
1992
right. To now. Do you see a difference in education now as compared to then? Has it changed a lot or pretty much kept the same path?
Well, that's a bigger topic,
yeah,
right? Because
I know
the funding mechanisms have changed a lot, I think, since that time. It was super competitive, and There were a great number of my friends who did become doctors and are quite, you know, endured and caring for their patients in a really wonderful way. The problem is the system. The system is now, you know, turning into a cookie cutter mm-hmm. environment where a lot of folks in medicine are feeling disenfranchised and unable to treat the person in front of them. But not being a doctor, I was a young mom and I had been, you know, taught very little about vaccines, and I was just told you have to go to the pediatrician based on this schedule, but I wasn't really told why. And on the first visit, I allowed my son to get a battery of vaccines, and he really never stopped screaming from that moment onward. Right?
Oh my
gosh. He had this terrible high-pitched scream and a horrible instant reaction.
Do you know about how many shots he got, or just a bunch?
Well, isn't that terrible? A lot of moms aren't told what went in to the child. We had to pull that apart later on, but you know, the schedule today at 2 months would be 7 vaccines at once, right? So you're talking about almost every limb of the body, and you really don't know what caused it, which one caused it, right? In his case, the doctor was pretty convinced it was the DPT shot, but he wasn't sure.
Mm-hmm.
It just was the one that seemed to have caused the greatest number of reactions. So we went into full recovery mode with him, and that's where I started really learning more about the products themselves, but also, you know, how to reverse some of the damage that can be done.
Yeah. Did he get fully recovered?
He's pretty fully recovered. If you see him, he's a very robust, smart kid, and he's doing well.
Did it take a long time for that to happen?
It took us a few years, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, to really find help, because there was a lot of denial at first, although the pediatrician acknowledged that it could have been the shots. It was pretty obvious that it was.
Yeah.
He had classical symptoms of vaccine reactions. And so, you know, my background being in microbiology, I started learning about the diseases themselves and how to recognize them.
Mm-hmm.
And I started reading as much as I could about what you can do to treat childhood illness, because I knew that for him, giving any more vaccines would be incredibly unsafe.
Ah.
Right?
So this wasn't the end. I mean, he should have gotten more.
Well, at the time, it was the first round. You know, when I say first round, I really mean it, because these days they give 74 doses to children from birth to age 18. And so largely within the first 2 years of life. So all those pediatric visits were set up already for them. You know, every 2 months, every 4 months, 8 months, 12 months, 15 months, 18 months, 24 months, and the child gets a battery at every run. They're supposed to protect the children at the time that the children would be coming into contact with the diseases themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, there are severe reactions that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do happen, it is important to recognize them as a reaction so you can do something about it.
Yeah. Do you happen to know statistics, like percentages of kids that have reactions? Or I don't know that information. I guess it's hard to find, but I was just wondering, just thinking the risk versus benefit analysis, you know?
Well, now that we're into these questions, I can see why Front Porch Forum refused to post. But, you know, it's tricky for a lot of folks to really accept. I thought that it was one in a million. That's what I was told. And it's not really something that you usually sit and have coffee on the radio and talk about, right? So,
but
you know,
you
I thought it was one
to.
In the million. And flash forward, you know, so here we go. We decided to move to the Valley 15 years ago, full time. We have had a connection to Vermont forever, for generations, I would say. And this was a homecoming for us.
So you've had family that had a place here, lived here? And that's what brought you. I was wondering how you ended up in
Both
Vermont.
Both of us have family, yes, from Vermont. And flash forward to going into school, I had just filed exemptions for the children because we were picking and choosing and selectively deciding not to vaccinate at that point. The more I learned, the unsafer it felt to proceed. And so at that time, there was legislation introduced to remove parents' rights to be able to choose these vaccines, and that was really that moment I think changed my life. Yeah. It's how I got involved in this, all of these advocacy groups,
because that was 10 years ago.
12 years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was late 2011. Mm-hmm. We were just finishing up Irene Relief, and a young girl up in the Northeast Kingdom had just passed away 2 days after an influenza vaccine. Aww. She died of myocarditis, which is heart inflammation. She died in her mother's arms, and her mother was featured in the news. And the reaction, the solution that was proposed by the health agencies was to remove the parents' rights to opt out. Mm-hmm. Because parents were beginning to hear these stories of children passing away, and they were beginning to have concerns over the safety.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the safety is an issue because, so what I thought was one in a million, when that began to happen, parents started calling out of the woodwork.
When this little girl died.
Yes, telling their own stories.
Really?
And we realized, wait, this is way more common than we thought. And the legislature held a hearing, and over 300 people showed up, each one of them with their own story to tell, right here in Vermont in 2012.
That's incredible.
I had no idea that it was so common until I really stepped out and said this happened to me, and then it started. Other people, not just me, there were others that had come before me, too, that I wasn't aware of. And I have been working a long time to try to let folks know that this can happen, and that you should know. There's no liability. That's a really big deal.
That's, I don't know if you want, do you want to jump into that, or should we?
Well, why don't you let me know if you've got questions?
Okay.
Totally up to you. But, I think that the stats now are pretty overwhelming. There is a reporting system. It often goes unnoticed by consumers.
Yeah.
I think it's right
theirs.
Around. Yes, that's called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and that's a passive safety outlet where people can report if they know that safety outlet even exists.
Mm-hmm.
If their doctor won't report it, they can make their own report. Based on those stats, it's way more than one in a million. When the CDC decided to do an active surveillance back in 2011, I believe, may have been even earlier than that, they found 1 in 39 people were reacting to shots.
Oh, my gosh. 1 in 39?
That's much more than one in a million. they never funded any further research, so that's the last data point we have. But that's it. 1 in 39, it doesn't mean 1 in 39 people died, but it does mean that they had a significant event that, they had to go for medical treatment soon after, right?
So I've heard the argument against VAERS is that anyone can put a report on VAERS. There's no vetting process. Just anybody can go in and put a report. So you can't trust the numbers that are put there. And what would you say to that? I'm playing the devil's advocate here. I mean, that is true, right? Anyone can put a report onto VAERS.
It's absolutely true. But I would say, okay, so the whole VAERS system is totally misunderstood by most people, and I can see why, because it should be a government system that's actually advertised to consumers. That was the way it was set up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was set up as a package in 1986. As part of legislation that A, shielded the manufacturers from liability, and then B, created this intentional reporting system so that there would be at least some safety for surveillance. And it took the safety surveillance off the shoulders of Big Pharma and put it onto CDC and FDA. So VAERS is actually the official place where government reports go in pharma's reports go in and consumer reports, meaning healthcare providers or young parents' reports go in. So yes, mm-hmm. anybody can make a report, but it's the official system. It's the mm-hmm. official surveillance system. And it was created under the statute to do so. And mm-hmm. in the past, there were recalls based on just a few dozen deaths after vaccines. After that package went through in 1986, the liability shield went in. The data are collected, but there aren't any more recalls.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of our son, he received a shot that should have been recalled, wasn't recalled. They decided to sell down the stock. That shot was called Tripedia. The reason it was taken off the market was because it had ingredients in it that were supposed to be removed. But they literally didn't recall the product.
Is a shot that your son was given, and then this was recalled?
This was a product that they had already said, we won't sell this product any, we won't make this product anymore. But they never took it off the shelves. They just sold down the stock.
You're kidding.
And this is part of the problem. The 1986 Act was supposed to be created so that vaccines could be more widely distributed, but that there would be a greater safety surveillance and then compensation for injuries. But it's turned into denial, as you can see, because VAERS is denied as even being trustworthy, even though it's the Sentinel system where reports are supposed to be made.
Wow.
So when a report goes in, sometimes they'll come back and ask for medical records, other times not. So most parents will tell you that if their child has gone into the VAERS system, there's no benefit to that system. If you want to gain compensation for permanent injury, you have to actually file with a compensation program. So that all exists for all the vaccines for children. Mm-hmm. And then there's actually an additional program for the COVID vaccines and additional liability protection too.
How often are parents told, like, let's say your child gets vaccinated, a few weeks later they have an adverse health condition event, and how often are they told, well, it could be from the vaccine? Like, is that... That's where I think one of the problems lies that I've seen just with COVID, and, you know, no one seems to consider the fact that it could possibly be a side effect from the vaccine. So I don't know, before COVID, was that a problem also, or were they more open about considering that?
I think that if you speak with parents who've been through it, they'll tell you that it's virtually zero. I mean, in my case, I was lucky. The pediatrician had gotten the urgent call. He could hear the cryoencephalotique, is what they call it. You know, there were symptoms there that he couldn't deny, but at the same time did. And only after many, many, many moons would even help us file a VAERS report. And only after I found out that it existed, that you could file a report, that there was this system in place, we educated the doctor, who actually left his practice shortly afterwards for unknown reasons. Most parents I've found have had injuries, or their children have experienced injuries, have told me that there's been massive denial here in Vermont and elsewhere. It's really partly because the idea is that there's no way that these products would be allowed on the market if they weren't properly tested for safety. And yet, without a liability, it's problematic because there's really no impetus to, you know, to focus on the safety piece.
It's
important to know what's in what you eat as well as in your medicines. So, you know, I encourage folks to just look into it. I mean, I think it's a really personal choice. It's a really personal choice, right?
It should be.
And you should always have the right to know more information and to say, gee, you know, I think I'll think about it, or take one at a time or not at all.
Yeah.
But depending on your own history and your risk tolerance.
So you founded the Vermont Coalition for Vaccine Choice, I'm guessing, after the experience you had with your son?
Well, we've been sort of all over the place, but it was back in 2011 when this bill came through. I had never even stepped foot in the state house, and I went in to see what was going on because I was really concerned that...
This is the bill taking parents' rights away mm-hmm. to have the choice. Yeah.
And so the Senate room was full of pharma lobbyists. And when somebody said something they liked, everybody nodded. And when they said something they didn't like, they would all type into their machines and hit send. And I was wondering what was going on here. There were multiple people, and somebody taught me how to go look at the book and figure out who they were and who they worked for. And we easily figured out that, you know, it was very...
So they sign in. And sign in who they're representing? Is that it? And so
you have to kind of figure that out. Nowadays, there are tags, and if people are being paid to be there, they have to wear a tag. But it's, I turned to the young moms that had shown up too and said, uh-oh, we better do something much bigger than this. And we got together in somebody's kitchen, and we formed this Vermont Coalition for Vaccine Choice. There were parents and scientists and doctors and nurses and grannies that were concerned too, and we all got together and we created a website and a Facebook page. It was really grassroots at the time.
Wow.
And we created this hearing with all these people who came with their stories. So the legislature ultimately decided 133-6 to keep this exemption in place, and it's a real balance between
133-6?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a huge success.
It was a huge success, and it was really...
in spite of all those pharma lobbyists.
Well, you know,
you.
We're all human, and when we show yeah. up and when people yeah. really speak to an issue and are allowed to speak and be heard,
yeah.
that was really what our coalition was doing, was, trying to create an avenue for people to have a seat at the table because mm-hmm. their families were affected. So, you know, that... Flash forward, we are now Health Choice Vermont. We're still advocating for the right to consent, the right to have information, the right to be heard and to speak at the legislature, all those things. And we're still grassroots. We're still volunteer. And I don't even really know why or how sometimes we're all still doing what we're doing. But with COVID, it really became clear that people need to understand that there were already existing safety concerns. And now there are even additional liability protections that have been placed that most people don't know about.
Yeah. Success that you had with keeping was that a religious exemption or a philosophical exemption that you were able to sustain?
So I think it's important to go back to the origins of these exemptions. But yes,
mm-hmm.
it was... a philosophical exemption. Exemptions were created in Vermont law in 1979. We were actually the only state left standing that hadn't created school vaccine mandates.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was happening in parallel with all of this liability discussion and lots of lawsuits. So when in 1979 the legislature was approached by the Department of Health, Roberta Coffin was her name, the building's named after her. She went in and she said, we'd like to offer MMR vaccine and a few other vaccines, probably not DPT because that one is too reactive, but we'd like to offer these vaccines for school, and we want to create a school recommended schedule, but of course it will be the right of the parents. So there was a long discussion, and they carved out, they said, okay, we'll put the schedule together, but we're going to give parents the right to say no. There was a big discussion, yes, on the basis of religion, but also for parents who just want to be able to say no to having a serum injected into their child, basically with their words. We will create a moral or philosophical exemption for those parents. And the doctors all said yes, because that means there's full informed consent. They'll be
right.
allowed to choose to do it for school or to say no. So those exemptions have been in place throughout every state all along.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until 2011 where they began to start trying to take away these exemptions from parents, and we were all like, wait a minute, what's going on here, right?
Yeah, and they used the public safety argument, I guess.
They actually said that vaccination rates were dropping and that there were going to be outbreaks. And when we looked into their data, it actually showed that the vaccination rates had never been higher in the history of history.
So, but the infectious disease rate was going up.
Yes.
Along with the vaccination rate. Sounds a lot like COVID.
It does, actually.
Wow,
how about that? In fact, the pertussis whooping cough story is really, it almost, now that you mention it, you know, they were giving up to six doses to the children at school, yeah. And the children who were getting the highest number of doses were actually getting pertussis. And
wow.
All the scientists were actually publishing about it. And so it was out
well,
there in the mainstream.
Well, that's different than COVID. There's
well,
a difference.
Same with COVID. It's out there in the mainstream, but you know the narrative is, oh no, you just need more. We maybe need to add a seventh dose, or you know, you need more doses,
or you would be sicker,
or yes, or it's a mild disease, which is interesting because if you design something to prevent a serious disease, then obviously it should impact the
disease. Oh, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that about pertussis increasing along with the vaccination rate. Jeez.
Mm. And yeah. MMR, everybody knows the story. 2015 came along. There were measles outbreaks happening in the vaccinated mm-hmm. populations. And the story was that it was because there were unvaccinated people living amongst the vaccinated, which,
yeah.
again, is a parallel to today,
yeah.
right? With those folks who have chosen to say no, being perfectly healthy, mm-hmm. but being accused of being somehow
a super spreader.
Spreader, yes.
Or a spreader, or oh my gosh.
You know, these products were developed to prevent disease, but we've seen an explosion of chronic disease in children. And the VAERS Awareness Project was something we did many, many years ago to try to bring to light some of the compensated injuries and the documented injuries that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really interesting because that list hasn't changed much. The COVID vaccine seems to also have the same injuries on that list. Like if you look at
wow.
what the FDA wrote on their list of adverse vaccine injuries to of interest, I think is what they called them.
Yeah.
You know, they had Guillain-Barré syndrome, autoimmune disease, paralysis, death, allergic reaction, encephalitis, seizures.
Wow.
These are things that can happen if your immune system goes awry.
Yeah.
So those reports are still rolling in. And as you know, there are a lot of folks right now calling for a full-on stop while they examine the safety data.
Yeah, but you don't hear about that too often. You know.
Right.
Which we could get into censorship, which I just do want to mention that people who would normally be listening to our show, I don't think are listening today because I always post it in Front Porch Forum. And they wouldn't post my interview with you, Jennifer.
And, you know, I would just say that people can find the other side of the story on all of the widely available websites, right? So
yeah.
they can go to the CDC, they can go to the WHO, they can go to healthvermont.gov. You know, we're not opposed to information of all sorts. Being out there in the public domain is what it's all about. It's important for people to have information to make informed decisions.
How else do you make an informed decision, really, if you can't get access to all the information?
Yeah, and it's not all gloom and doom. There are things that you can really do to keep yourself healthy, to regain your health. The wellness continuum is not all downhill. And I'm not
yeah.
peddling product at all or any services. I'm just saying that I've seen it with my own eyes. People can recover. The body can heal. It can be a long slog. In our case, it took years to really fully recover our own child.
And did you say your daughter is not vaccinated at all?
You know, I don't like to tell people what
yeah.
our vaccination status is because it's such a sensitive
it
deal
is in
and
private.
The bullying can be real. But I will say that for the vast majority of vaccines that I have personally researched, I have mm-hmm. found that they're not safe enough for our own family.
Yeah.
And that was really reinforced last April when my mother was sent to the hospital without the use of her legs with symptoms of Guillain-Barré after taking a Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So
for COVID.
You know, that really highlights the family history that we seem to have when it comes to these products, unfortunately.
Yeah, I can just speak personally for myself that I had a polio vaccine, and that's the only vaccine I've ever had. I've never gotten a flu vaccine, and I'm 68. I'm really healthy, and people say you're an exception when I say that, but I don't think I am. I think if you eat right and exercise and get outside and don't take all these drugs that they push, you'll be healthy. I think most people that do that are healthy, doesn't it? I mean, you're a health... What is your title? Like a homeopathic physician, would you...
No, definitely not physician. So I'm a lay homeopath. Homeopathy is one of those beautiful things that anybody can learn. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely zero science proving how it works, and yet 2 billion people across the planet use it and swear by it. And it's safe, cheap, what can...
Accessible.
Placebo, who knows, right? But... Yeah. But if you do nothing, that's an option too. And if you use vitamins, anybody listening who uses vitamin supplements, then you believe in natural health options, right? It doesn't it doesn't mean that you're, I was late today because I was making my tinfoil hat or something like that, right? It just means that, I've seen really sick people get better, and it usually starts with them, right? They have to make a personal decision to take that step forward to make it a change. Mm-hmm. And it usually has to do with not following the latest advice, or especially taking the latest and greatest until you watch and see how it worked out. I mean, the Vioxx story is a good one. A lot of people live through thalidomide. The Qatar incident, the polio vaccine, a lot of people remember. That paralyzed several hundred, killed 55, it was taken off the market really rapidly. Mm-hmm. That was before the liability protections.
And the liability, that's the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act that was passed in 1986, I think, right?
Yeah,
it was signed. Do you want to just talk about that? Because I really think people are not aware. Because to me, this thing is horrific.
I think for me, it was a showstopper when I learned about
it. Yeah, me too.
It really was.
Me too.
An industry that has been, really widely marketing directly to consumers, spending lots of money doing so ever since the early 90s.
Which is totally baffling in the just that alone.
Mm-hmm. And has been found guilty of multiple...
Fined how many times? How much money?
We put a document together years ago, and the list was very, very long, but Pfizer had topped the list for $3 billion fine for false advertising and all sorts of fraudulent things. And so, the people aren't evil, but people need information to make good decisions.
Exactly.
Right? And so in this case, the 1986 Act was signed into law at the very last day of Congress. And Reagan at the time...
We gotta get out of here, we'll just sign, okay.
Well, Reagan at the time actually said he had concerns because he didn't think that there was any... He was concerned that the law trampled on constitutional protections, actually. But the law went into place. It was bundled in a package that allowed for drugs to be shipped overseas without FDA approval. So it meant big bucks for our U.S.-based industries.
Economy.
But wrapped in it was the 1986 Act, which actually those who were on the vaccine injury side had also helped lobby for in order to get just compensation for those who were injured.
Wow, really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Which was the nexus of the beginning of that law was to try to get compensation for injury. But what ended up happening was the injury compensation got flipped on its head, and the government started paying for the injuries rather than pharma. And pharma walked away with a liability shield.
Just to put it in very simple terms, what this act says is...
We like to summarize it to say what it really means is that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. And the act itself says no vaccine manufacturer shall be held liable in a civil action for damages arising for vaccine-related injury or death. associated with the administration of a vaccine after October 1st, 1988, if the injury or death resulted from side effects that were unavoidable, even though the vaccine was properly prepared and accompanied by proper directions and warnings. What this means is you're supposed to be warned, and you're always supposed to be allowed to say no. That's what it really means, and that's why the exemptions were put into place, and that's why, in the beginning, most legislatures said, no, we're going to keep the exemptions. Right? So flash forward, the industry was gaining steam. They came after Vermont only second. They went after multiple states throughout the nation trying to remove these exemptions. And now we have COVID. So at this point, after the 1986 shield went into place, the schedule exploded to 7 times what it was for children. And now I think most adults are realizing that they're fair game for these schedules too. So yeah. Mandates for work became prevalent. Mm-hmm. Mandates for healthcare workers, mandates for college students.
Teachers.
Mandates are rolling out now for adults. And it's a big concern because we don't have exemptions built into law. We have the presumption that we're going to be allowed to say yes or no, but the COVID mandates highlighted the fact that this is a real problem, that we need to get rid of the liability shields at the bare minimum, to place responsibility back where it belongs, and I believe that the mandates would not get pushed so aggressively.
Yeah.
And injuries would be recognized, and people could get potentially better help.
And I guess the question anybody would ask is, if they're safe and effective, the vaccines and the injections, whatever, and that's a whole other subject that we might not have time to get into, but if they're safe and effective, why do they need this liability shield? You know, I mean, if you have a safe and effective product, okay, go ahead, put it out there. I don't need a liability shield because my product is safe and effective, right?
Right. And the American Academy of Pediatrics also lobbied for that liability shield too, which, you know, I mean, most pediatricians at the end of the day don't want to give something that's going to hurt somebody.
Right.
As humans.
I believe that.
Right? Absolutely mm-hmm. not. Nurses, no. Are you kidding? No way. I mean, these are the folks who literally spend the most time laying their heart on the line for somebody else.
So why did they lobby for this?
Well, the lobbyists are different. You know, the lobby organizations are not necessarily practicing. Or if they are, mm-hmm. they're, you know, lobbying a certain position that has, I don't know. I have a very hard time with that because I know a lot of folks who really believe in this product being, as like you said, it couldn't possibly be anything other than safe and effective. The 1986 Act was passed because the manufacturers threatened to go out of business and to stop manufacturing these products. The polio vaccine, the DPT vaccine, and even the MMR vaccine had huge lawsuit pileups. They were paying out hundreds of millions, and they were facing even more in pileups. So the deal was, we really want you to keep making these products, so we're going to make this deal with you, and we'll take the hit. The government will do the safety tracking. We'll do the safety reports. We'll take it from here, basically.
But why would they want them to keep making products that were hurting people? I don't get it. Why would they
Well,
want
even
that?
Back then, they had said, there's not going to be any discussion about this. It's going to hurt a few people, and we're going to create this program. And since the inception of the program, they've paid out nearly $5 billion in injuries since 1988. So that's a huge number. So that's, you know, I mean, people will say, well, that's not proof. Well, okay, so those were compensated injuries paid out by the taxes that go into the purchase of these products. So there is a compensation program. The presumption is some people will get injured.
Collateral damage?
It's really hard to accept when it's one of yours and one of your loved ones that it's happened to. And I have met parents who, yes, they have told me that their children developed autism after vaccines. And I have met parents who've actually gone through the vaccine court fighting for compensation for some of those children. And I think that brain injury is a wide thing, and it's a very big claim, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you really read the science and see what has happened in there is this court. There aren't any depositions. There's no discovery. It's a closed circuit system. Basically, these are appointees. So it's not a real court. It's supposed to be. They compensate, but they don't presume any guilt, right? They say the vaccine didn't cause it, but we'll pay for your injury
just because we like you.
So I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah,
or not.
It kind of does. Do you happen to have the statistics with you on autism? Like, say, 40 years ago, the percentage of kids who developed autism compared to today? Or do you know?
There are whole books that are written about it, actually.
Yes, there are.
So one of the experts on this topic wrote a book called Denial.
Mm-hmm.
And he tracked the history in the 1940s being at about 1 in 10,000.
Mm.
And the last I checked, each state rate is different. But New Jersey, for example, the highest rates were in boys. And some of those were 1 in 29 boys. That's a huge number.
Wow.
Of course, the...
1 in 29 boys have autism?
The diagnosis.
Wow.
Now, 1 in 29 boys in New Jersey, which is the highest rate in the country.
Huh.
Right.
Do you have any insight into why that is?
Well...
Sorry.
I'm not an expert there, so I probably will pass on that question. But
okay.
There are whole books written on it. And I think J.B. Handley's book is really important.
I read that.
How to End the Autism Epidemic.
Yeah.
You know, even if you titled it something different, he did a really nice job in 5-6 chapters,
mm-hmm.
summarizing this issue of the birth of the vaccine program, the liability protection, the amount, and his son actually was severely injured by vaccinations. And
yeah.
He strongly believes, and most of the medical professionals behind him strongly believe, that their son was vaccine injured and that his diagnosis of autism was a result. So there are bigger thinkers around that topic than me.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't have, you know, a child that was injured that badly, or maybe fortunately because we were able to find people to help us recover him. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you stopped the vaccine process, right?
Yes, and I think, you know, when you said what causes it, I think right now we live in a really toxic world, and we're so lucky in the Madera Valley to be where we are. We have so many blessings in terms of clean air and clean water and
farmers,
you know, outdoor lifestyle and local food,
yeah,
and great people and the ability to be active. So, but chemical poisonings are real and they happen in many ways. You know, people mostly think about calling poison control if their child, I don't know, fill in the blank, drinks the latest bag of bug juice, or in our case, it was bug juice but there are pesticides out there now that are sprayed pretty pervasively that can cause a lot of damage. I think it's a burden on our systems, all of our systems, in terms of what builds up in our livestock if they're not, you know, raised in a really clean way. And then you've got medicines. I mean, most people think of, we are lucky to have our hospitals and our urgent care systems and our ability to go get patched up whenever we need to. We're really lucky. And at the same time, we do overprescribe. There were actual pills on the floor of the hospital that we were checking out of a few years ago, and the woman next to us says, I see this all the time. I couldn't believe it, right? But we are a really highly medicated society. And if you look at the ingredients in all of these drugs, you know, they cross-react for a reason. A lot of them are chemicals. Mm-hmm. A lot of smart chemists out there, toxicologists exist because there is a limit beyond which it becomes toxic, right?
Right.
So I think detoxing is a really big buzzword around springtime, but it's a really important way to clean out your system and be able to.
And I'm sorry, how do you do that? What do you want to go into that, or
well,
is
you know,
that
I think a lot
a little too close to medical advice.
Yeah, I think that we would have to do that another time, and I'm not a specialist either. But detoxing is important, particularly with injuries like that and medical injuries in general. Drugs, vaccines, whatever they are, getting cleaned up is important. Cleaning up your liver, cleaning up your kidneys, you know, cleaning up your diet.
Yeah,
trying not to eat things out of boxes is a good start. Yeah. You know, we all have our weaknesses, but there are ways to take vitamins. Even like high dose vitamin C is something that is extremely controversial, and yet many practitioners use it today in clinics throughout the world with great success to try to pull, because it's an antioxidant, pull things out of the body.
I didn't realize it was controversial.
I guess anything that is not a FDA-approved claim, can't diagnose, treat, or cure, you can't make claims for, it can be controversial. But vitamin treatments, you know, the early treatments that they were using in China for COVID were actually high-dose vitamin C treatments, ozone treatments, ivermectin and zinc, things that they were giving out, you know, throughout the world that seemed to be banned here. Go figure.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. So I think just reading and reading the literature, nowadays we have such great access to information. You don't have to go travel to go to a library. You can get a lot of things online. You have to know what sources to trust and what not to trust. There's a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there on all sides.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And sometimes it's hard. Yeah.
You know, so Children's Health Defense was founded by a group of individuals who are really aware of environmental health. And, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the chairman of Children's Health Defense, and his work for so many years was helping to clean up our rivers and lakes.
He cleaned up the river I grew up on, and I just love him forever for that.
And I think we all have stories like that to tell. And you know, I think that he really is dedicated to protecting the future of our children, and he knows how big polluters get away with this. And he's really trying to help all of us, you know, protect our future, defend our human and planetary health, protect our environmental health by, you know, really proactively working to eliminate the exposures, that eliminate the harmful substances that are making people sick, because there is a lot of evidence about specific substances that are causing massive illness in our human population. And so one of the main goals is really to hold those who are responsible accountable in terms of toxic exposures, particularly around our children, and then working with the system to establish safeguards to prevent future violations. So this is really not about banning stuff or making stuff not accessible. It's really about ensuring that if we're going to have first-class health system, that we are doing things in a first-class way when it comes to ensuring the outcomes are what we want them to be, which is healthy people, right?
Exactly. By the way, I am speaking to Jennifer Stella, and she is a homeopath. She co-founded Health Choice Vermont, and she's the leader for Children's Health Defense New England, which was just established, 2 months ago, maybe 3 months ago? Recently, we
launched in the fall. We have a new website. It's new.childrenshealthdefense.org. And you can also go to the national site, which is childrenshealthdefense.org, and sign up there, and you'll get on our mailing list for New England You know, we really just want to create an informed and motivated populace who can help us continue to strengthen everything, the local economy. We're protecting civil rights, we're trying to establish food security, regenerate our natural environment, a lot of the things that people in our world are already doing. We're just trying to bring in the knowledge that there are other ways except for the one true way, you know, and mandates don't work for people because inevitably people do get hurt and there are better ways. So we need to ensure that people have choices.
Yeah.
And for those who are listening who may have sick family members, you know, if you connect with the organization itself, there are multiple resources, medical resources that are available. Children's Health Defense does not do health advice, but we do have a large, broad network of doctors who are treating long COVID and vaccine injury patients. And so you can always at least search out the site for more information.
Yeah, a lot of those doctors are world-renowned, highly credentialed, you know, people in the medical and scientific field that are really worth, you know, considering.
And they have a lot of experience. They're just tired of the government oversight and control that's coming along with being told how to practice medicine. And then in addition, the corporate profit-driven model, which isn't working for the patients or even for the employees of the medical system right now.
Yeah.
And so my heart is out to all the frontline workers who have been really through the ringer. A lot of people who have lost their jobs, haven't even been rehired yet, or had to walk away because they wouldn't take either the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth jabs.
Yeah.
And at this point really would like to have a future that doesn't include having to line up every 6 months. So we're really trying to establish some local legislation in Vermont and elsewhere throughout New England.
We might go over a few minutes, but that's okay. I would like you to mention these bills.
Yes, and actually, so if I put on my Health Choice Vermont hat, we are a local advocacy organization that works with the legislature to try to promote the right of informed consent, which is, you know, really should be nothing that the government grants you, but recognizes
a human right,
you know, that nobody can deny. And so we have Vermont Representative Mark Higley is fighting for all Vermonters who want to make their own informed vaccine decisions, and now and in the future. So he and his co-sponsors have introduced a package of bills that will protect all patients, including students and workers and parents, in case of minors, from mandates. And, you know, what we're really asking for is people who are concerned about having that right to be able to say yes or no, to please send a message to their state representative in support of the health choice bills, basically. I'll just read out the numbers. It's kind of boring, but 182, 187, 188, and 189, they're all House bills. Basically to protect students and workers from discrimination, to ensure that we all have access to accurate vaccine information, and that you have the protected right to make your own healthcare decisions without being coerced or punished if you decide to say yes or no. So again, it's about the right to choose, which we all agree people should always have.
Yeah, I just want to say too,
the right to refuse becomes
Our representatives are Kari Dolan and Dara Tori, so they would be the two, if you're in the Valley, that you'd want to contact. And if you really do care about this issue, the more of us who let them know that we do care about it, the more clout we'll have with them.
So yeah, really, and really, important, you know, asking them to support legislation that protects us, the people, the students, the workers, the backbone of Vermont, from harmful mandates that don't allow for people to have privacy and the right to opt out.
Yeah. Do you want to run those numbers one more time for the bills?
Sure. So H-182 is an act relating to bodily autonomy and your own healthcare decision-making, which protects your right to decide for yourself without anybody forcing you one way or the other or bribing you. H-187, which is an act relating to widening the exemptions for schools that we were talking about, and bringing back that conscientious philosophical exemption for all parents and all students.
And that is gone now? That was taken away?
That's correct. So there is a religious exemption, and religion in Vermont is the right to follow your own conscience according to your own God's will. Mm-hmm. So you really should not be questioned in any way. However, you shouldn't also have to be part of an organized or religious practice in order to make a medical decision. And so adding a conscientious exemption back into law is what H-187 is all about. And H-188 is relating to giving people the right information before taking a shot. In other words, right now, you're not required to be given any information at all. Wouldn't it be nice
That's
if
good.
You at least were given some basic information?
It kind of reminds me of you go to the store and you buy food and it comes in a bag or a box or a can and it doesn't have any information. It just says peas.
Right.
That's it.
And you're like, well, how do you know it's peas? It looks a little different.
Or what else is in there? Just peas? Nothing else?
Yes. And so in the case of informed consent prior to the administration of a shot, what we would be asking for is just enough so that, like when you pick up a drug at the pharmacy, you get that package insert.
Yeah.
The idea would be that you would get that package insert. You'd be allowed to read what's in it, what are the reported risks, and you would be told that you have the right to say no.
Yeah.
Which right now is the opposite. Right. Right now it's take it or else, or it has been. I know we're kind of backing off of that right now.
That, you know, that just seems like such a common sense thing. It seems almost odd that you have to have a bill to pass to say we should have that right. I mean, we should have that right, you know? But I mean, it's like...
And, you know, we don't want to tell doctors how to practice medicine, but there are a lot of people who give vaccines. Right now, you know, with COVID, you just basically had volunteers in school gyms giving the shots. They weren't doctors necessarily. Most of them were nurses. But you've got a situation where, you know, the state is paying for the program, so they should standardize how the program rolls out. And they should measure the outcomes, too, not just the number of people that took the product, but what the outcomes were. So the Florida model, for example, is that they are monitoring all of their outcomes.
Really?
Every time somebody goes to the hospital, they have a fair way of assessing when their last shot was and how many shots they got, which lot numbers, and so on. And they're comparing the actual outcomes to the true unvaccinated and the vaccinated, and also fighting
for
consent.
I need to interrupt you for 1 second because I'm getting...
I'll get to that. So fighting for informed consent.
Yeah, we just have to say the station ID every hour, so we're going over. So I just need to say that this is WMRW, and our program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, Rootswork. Sorry to interrupt, but
I get
that out of the way.
Yeah, so if somebody asked what happened to the Nuremberg Code, and, you know, so Sandy Ryder wrote about this prolifically. He's a doctor. Most doctors, old-timers, know this, but informed
consent...
One
more plug. We're going to have him on next Friday.
Oh, okay, great.
Okay.
So informed consent really means that you have the right to be adequately warned about the risks of any procedure and the benefits of any procedure and the alternatives of any procedure, including the right to say no. And that basically comes from the fact that you, if you recall, there were very large atrocities after World War II, and there had been medical experimentation on folks who were not aware or were not given the right or the consent option. And so the Nuremberg Code was written to ensure that human experimentation never happens again, and the basis for informed consent laws throughout the nation in each state are basically written in such a way that you're supposed to have that right. In the case of vaccination, it's considered to be a public health product distributed by the CDC, and the CDC does not require any sort of informed consent. So every state is different, and we're trying to get state protections written into state laws so that at least people have the right to know what's in it.
Yeah.
I would not have said yes to aluminum-based anything, no matter how many times somebody said it was safe. I wouldn't have said yes to mercury-based anything if somebody had, you know, told me what was in there. So, you know, these bills are important. H-189 is the last one. This should be very simple, but it basically asks for the government to take a look at how many people have reported reactions after vaccination.
Wouldn't that be helpful?
Currently, nobody in the state follows that data.
That's really sad.
Yeah, and that's why people think it's perfectly safe, because they don't hear about the outcomes data.
Right.
They're not being followed or published anywhere.
No, it's censored, basically.
Yeah, but censored.
There's power in numbers, and I think the most important thing is, if you are listening and you do care about these issues, please contact our representatives, Dara Torrey, Kari Dolan, and who's our senator now? God, this is, just if you go into the Vermont State website, you'll see them and how to contact them. And
sign up too at healthchoicevt.com, because that's where you'll get more information about new bills that are coming. For better or for worse. Right now,
yeah,
we have four great bills, which is great.
Yeah.
So healthchoicevt.com is the local advocacy group.
Lots of information there. And I know Dara Torrey is doing these weekly sessions around the valley, one in Moortown, one at Three Mountain Cafe in Waitsfield. That one is the last Saturday of the month. So if you want to just mark that down, you can go in person and meet her and talk to her. And I think the in-person thing really helps, because that puts a face to the voice. And, you know, once you get to know someone, you have more respect for their opinion, I think. So the one-to-one contact really helps. So.
Well, Jerry, thank you
so
much.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer. Thank you for coming in and all that you've done for over a decade now, and for continuing to do it. Anything else you want to add that people might be able to do to promote any of these bills? I don't know.
Well, I would say that in terms of, you know, the legislature is just part of what we can do in terms of protecting ourselves. Obviously, if we have laws, that's the best way.
Yeah.
But public education is important too. And if you go to childrenshealthdefense.org, we are actually looking for folks to help, both locally and in other states. So if you have friends and family who are in other New England states, the New England chapter is definitely hoping to add you to the group and have you come to events, even help put on some events. Going into the summer, hopefully we'll be doing some environmental health workshops.
Great.
So stay tuned.
Yeah. And Seal, if you're listening, did you hear that? New Jersey needs a leader. Well, thanks everybody for listening. This has been Jerry with the 4-H Show. And as we did say a little while ago, next Friday, Amy and I will be together with Dr. Sandy Ryder. And he's just a great guy and a physician. And I don't know if you have anything to add to his credentials, but that'll be a really interesting conversation. So we're looking forward to that. I'm going to turn you over to Hal, and Gary Jackson will be in at 2 o'clock with Weekend Warm-Up. Have a great weekend. Hopefully the weather will improve. And we'll see you all next week.